recessed meeting from this afternoon. This afternoon. What was it this morning? I want to change the order that we have on the list here a little bit. Earlier agenda, we had Senate File 742, Senator Rosen's bill. The fourth one on the list is Senator Fischbach's 695. We're going to jump down to allow Senator Carlson, who's not a member of the committee, Senate File 374, to take up his bill first. I understand he does have a witness that has traveled some distance, and out of consideration for the fact that Senator Carlson is not probably here otherwise because he's not a member of the committee and his constituent or his testifier is not either. So, Senator Carlson, appreciate your being here this evening, and if you would introduce yourself for the record, and if you have your testifier do so as well, that would be great.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, I am Senator John Carlson from Senate District 4. With me today is Dr. Dan Rose, and I'll have in just a few minutes I'll have Dr. Rose identify himself. Senate File 374 modifies the medical assistance dental coverage for the aged, blind, and disabled by creating a new dental services program. Section 1 of the bill clarifies that dental coverage under the medical assistance program for the aged, blind, and disabled shall be provided under the dental services program. And then Section 2 creates that dental services program. At this time, I'm going to turn over to Dr. Rose, who will explain the need for the program, and then we'll stand for questions at the end.
Thank you, Senator Carlson, and thank you, Chairman Hahn, and members of the committee for the opportunity to be here and testify. For the record, my name is Dr. Daniel Rose. I practice dentistry in Pillager, Minnesota, and provide dental care at Lakewood Hospital in Staples, Minnesota. I have been providing for the disabled population for 32 years and am very concerned with what we have in front of us that we need to deal with. It's been well documented that the dental care for the vulnerable adults, that's the developmentally disabled, the mentally ill, compromised elderly, and that population, is a problem. About 28% of Medicaid enrollees are aged, blind, or disabled, and of that population, about a quarter of them can only receive their care in a hospital setting under general anesthesia. You have all received a packet, and in that packet is the is a two-page document, and I encourage you to read that at your leisure. A lot of good information in there. I'm just going to go through part of that and summarize things. The current state guidelines simply do not allow for non-coverage procedures, and as it currently stands, it's reasonable to expect persons that have some coverage to pay for those things that aren't covered. However, when we're dealing with the population of which I'm speaking of, these persons require special care. They have no income. They have no way of meeting their needs. They're totally dependent on the state of Minnesota for their well-being. They, in fact, as I see it, wards of the state of Minnesota. I am convinced that the law of unintended consequences has come into play with some of the decisions that have been made in the past year, and that's why I advocate strongly that this population be set aside and be provided those benefits, at least those that are afforded to children and pregnant mothers. A quote from the Surgeon General's report I think is important, and it says, quote, "Oral diseases and disorders in and of themselves affect health and well-being throughout life. The burden on oral problems is extensive and is particularly severe in vulnerable populations." The Oral Cancer Foundation on their own has reported that oral cancer claims more lives than leukemia, Hodgkin's lymphoma, laryngeal cancer, testicular cancer, thyroid cancer, skin cancer, and claims three times more victims than cervical cancer. If detected late, oral cancer, we see about a 22% survival. Detected early, we have about an 80% survival rate. Many of the compromised population take significant medications. It's not unusual to see a person taking 15, 20 medications. They're blind, they have seizure disorders, cerebral palsy, and Consequently, their saliva production is inhibited, so we see more dental decay. We see more periodontal disease. We just see more disease in general. I think that in summation, at this point, and then I would like to show you some slides, that there is simply a disproportionate amount of oral disease in this vulnerable population. And oral disease is consequential to overall health. There's an urgent need for treatment of any infection, including oral infection. It is not optional. Therefore, cost savings for medical treatment and or hospitalization, as well as emergency room visits, would be realized if dental care was provided in a timely manner. Failure to provide essential dental care will inevitably result in greater cost to the state, as payment will be necessary for costly consequences rather than early treatment or prevention. I'd like to show you some slides and go through it, and this will give you an indication of the individuals that we see. This is a picture of our clinic located in Pillager, Minnesota, where we have done a number of screenings of this population. We also see general dental patients at this clinic. This individual, and you can read this as well as I can, but this individual came to me, and many of these individuals, it is impossible to get an adequate examination on them. I have people come to me, and the caregivers say they have not had a set of x-rays in 14 years. Just recently, I saw an individual last Wednesday and said, I don't know when they've had a set of x-rays. I said, well, how long have they been living in your home? And she said, well, he's been there now 7 years, I guess, and I've taken him to the dentist a couple times. And every time I take them there, they really can't do anything. Even to do a limited examination, we're looking at people holding their hands, holding their head. We have about two or three people just involved to do a screening. This individual appeared to be without teeth until we put him in the operating room under general anesthesia, took x-rays, and we ended up surgically removing that whole area that looks like it doesn't have any teeth in it. Those are all root tips down underneath the gum tissue, infected and abscessed that showed up on the x-rays that you wouldn't see clinically. This individual, if you can see that, those two teeth at the top, we were able to restore those. Those behind there required surgical removal. These are all individuals that are severely compromised with cerebral palsy, traumatic brain injury, or otherwise. Another individual that just tells the story. Anterior teeth decay to the gum line, abscessed, painful, requiring surgical extraction. This individual came, and class 2 and class 3 mobility means they wave at you. Why this wasn't done before, I can't answer that question other than to say that we want to see 2 to 3 millimeter periodontal pockets. This person had 7 to 12 millimeter pockets. This fellow came to us, and if you look at that slide, there in the front where it looks like the teeth are tipped forward, that's really calculus deposits. Those little tips that you see up in the back, those are his teeth. We simply had to debride him before we could even do an adequate exam. And again, this is under general anesthesia. All these individuals had to be done under general anesthesia. This fellow is an interesting story. That you see growing on his teeth is many things, but it's not healthy. This fellow does not allow anyone to touch his face. Therefore, while he's under general anesthesia, they come in and they clean his ears, clip his toenails and his fingernails, give him a haircut, and shave him. He is an interesting fellow. With the current situation, we can see him once a year. This person right here, you can see the decay and the staining of those teeth. Left untreated, they're going to be abscessed and decayed. Obvious. How about this lad, 14 years old, severely mentally ill, required removal of 20 teeth on a 14-year-old boy. Those are the slides. They tell the story pretty dramatically, I think. This is what I see every week in the hospital, providing care for these patients from about 150-mile radius. We've seen patients from as far away as Hallock and from as close as Pillager, where the clinic is. I want to say that the need is to provide adequate care versus what I call episodic care. In the past, many of these individuals, what I mean by episodic care is when something breaks or it's obvious that something hurts or there's a lot of swelling, we take them to our local dentist. And that was the plan when these individuals were put in group homes around the state. They go to the dentist, and as I mentioned earlier, if two or three people involved with attempting to do something with them, they will maybe get one thing done, and that is the one thing that's hurting them at that time, but there's no comprehensive care provided. I know that the current set of benefits that exist today do not meet the minimum standard of care. That is a fact. What is adequate care? I'm not talking about Cadillac plans. I'm talking about relieving pain, eliminating infection, and establishing function. Again, I'm saying that the law of unintended consequences is going to come into play. Cutting benefits costs more for this population. Emergency room at Lakewood Hospital, you walk in the door and it's $469. You can just do some multiplication. Restoring a tooth versus removing a tooth, I think the situation speaks for itself. The most vulnerable in the state of Minnesota are the most needing. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Those are my comments. I would entertain any questions that any member of the committee or that you would have, sir.
Thank you, Dr. Rose. Senator Peterson, any questions from members of the committee? Senator Carlson, sorry, I think I called you Senator Peterson. I apologize for that. There is a fiscal note. Any comments you would want to make on the fiscal note?
I would just say this, Mr. Chair. First of all, I know that during these tough budget times, it's difficult to find money for programs. I would say this, that the role of government is to provide public safety, education, infrastructure, and care for our most vulnerable. And I believe that once we've met those tests, we can hold our heads high and say we are a good society. There's lots of things that the government spends money on that are unnecessary. Or might be wonderful to have, but aren't that necessary. Regarding the fiscal note, I believe that those were expenses that the state of Minnesota was incurring prior to the last budget shortfall, and those services were removed. The impetus for this bill, as brought to me by Dr. Rose and his colleagues, was to make sure that as we start to trim back on what government provides for our citizens, that we remember those pillars of what our government needs to do, and that is one of those is taking care of our most vulnerable. We're not asking to take care of every single adult. We're asking to take care of those that are most vulnerable. And I think that, as Dr. Rose pointed out, if we look at the cost in preventative care versus the cost of the episodic care down the road, the cost that will incur when someone has a abscessed tooth that ends up giving an infection in the body and putting them in a life-threatening situation, and we incur thousands and tens of thousands of dollars of emergency room and hospital stays when it could have been so easily have been eliminated through proper dental care on a regular basis, I think that the number becomes very small.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Carlson, it's nice to have somebody from the other side of the aisle who is concerned about adequate dental care for our most vulnerable citizens. I would just like to give you a little explanation of how we've ended up where we are with this program. Two bienniums in a row, Governor Pawlenty proposed eliminating dental care for all adults. Eliminating, not reducing, eliminating. And we had to work very hard because, you know, we had to balance the budget without raising taxes to find a way to keep dental services going at some level for people that needed them. I might just add that we worked with the dental community in coming up with what would be maybe not in your mind adequate, but a reasonable benefit set in light of the fact that the entire program was scheduled to be eliminated in the governor's budget in its entirety. Not only did the governor propose eliminating dental care for all adults, he also proposed eliminating every state-operated dental program in the state. And the population they serve are the disabled. And we managed to save those programs also. So I am glad to have someone on the other side of the aisle that is concerned about this issue and is willing to work on trying to restore these benefits and these programs, because really and truly we need to restore them for all low-income people. It costs just as much if you're in an emergency room because you're low-income and can't get dental care as it does if you're low-income and you are disabled and can't get dental care. And we are paying today, you know, over 10,000 emergency room visits for people that are in oral pain, and there is nothing that we're paying for that's going to cure the problem. So thank you for introducing this bill.
Other questions? Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Berglund, thank you for your comments. I would tell you that I don't know that this class of adults, the aged, the blind, and the disabled, have a particular political preference. We're not talking about a blind Republican or an aged Democrat. And I would prefer to leave the politics out of the equation. I just think it's our duty as a society to take care of our most vulnerable. Thank you.
Other questions from the committee? Are there any other people in the audience that wanted to testify on this bill?
Mr. Chairman.
Dr. Rose.
I'd like to make a comment, Mr. Chairman, if I may.
Certainly.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I just wanted to mention that an emergency room visit for this population, or any population, but I'm particularly interested in this population because of the fact that they are totally dependent on us for their well-being. ER visits, they're given pain medication and antibiotics if there's infection. What we're doing is breeding resistant bacteria and creating dependence. And it frustrates physicians as well as dentists. Senator Berglund, if I may say that I think that DHS, and maybe it was just overlooked in the hurriedness of what was being done, or however you want to define it, I don't know how to define it, but I think that there was just an unawareness that of the needs of this population when those decisions were made. Maybe I'm wrong. But I receive referrals from state-operated services for patients that they can't handle. So that's where I'm coming from on this. So, Mr. Chairman and Senator Berglund, I appreciate your interest, and I appreciate your encouragement. Thank you.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, it wasn't due to unawareness.
Okay.
Our preference would have been to keep the dental program we had. It was an attempt for hopefully a short period of time to provide something to people so that we would not end up not being able to provide anything, which would be, you have to admit, a much worse situation.
Thank you. With no further questions, my intent here, Senator Carlson, would be just to lay the bill over. We will consider it as we work on our budget bill, and we will, recognizing that there is a fiscal cost to your proposal, obviously a challenging year. We're going to try to do the best we can. So appreciate your bringing this to us. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman Hammond, members of the committee. We really appreciate the time. Thank you.
And thank you, Chairman Hahn and members of the committee. I appreciate it very much. And I am leaving my cell phone number with Senator Carlson's office if anyone has any personal questions, and an open invitation if anyone would like to come and spend a day with me in the hospital seeing these patients. I would welcome that. Thank you again.
Thank you, Doctor, for making the trip down. We want to take up at this point Senate File 731. It's my bill. I'm going to ask our Vice Chair, if Senator Rosen would be interested in chairing for the purposes of this bill. The reason we're going out of order here, members, is we do have some witnesses on 731 that have traveled some distance, and out of respect for their time, wanting to make sure that we're not keeping them too late. So thank you.
Senator Hand, when you're ready, Senate File 731.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Senate File 731 is a bill that would phase out the current rate equalization structure that we have in Minnesota for nursing facilities. This has been a policy that we've had for quite some time. I believe we are only one of two states that has retained this structure. I believe North Dakota is the only other state that does this, I think. I can be corrected on that. And what our current policy, in effect, does is require that the private pay patient, private pay residents pay the same amount as MA patients in nursing facilities. And what this bill would do is allow, over time, a rate increase for private pay patients above the MA allowable payment rate. And the schedule effect is, in effect, October of 2011, it would allow a 2% differential. In 2012, it would go up to 4%. 2013, 6%. 2014, 8%. And after that, there would be no restriction. So there would be a gradual phase-in of this policy. There is a fiscal note that you have that shows no budget impact to this. The assumptions are that the changes in the gradual differential increases would not have a significant effect on the MA enrollment, and so there is not a projected cost to the state budget for fiscal years 12, 13, 14, and 15. That's essentially what the bill does. This is an issue that many in the aging services community have talked about for some time, talked with me about over the years, and particularly this year. And we do have a witness from St. Benedict's Senior Care. I think she has got to make a trip back home here shortly, so we wanted to give her an opportunity to give her testimony before she has to leave. So
welcome, Ms. Back.
If you want to introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Christine Bakke, and I am the Care Center Administrator at St. Benedict Senior Community. We are a nonprofit provider of older adult services, and we see about 900 seniors just in our nursing home on an annual basis. The rate equalization law that was passed in 1976 was a time in Minnesota where nursing homes were reimbursed on a cost-based system. The Department of Human Services would annually gather a cost report in which we would list out all of our costs, and they would go through that cost report, determine what was allowable, and then set rates at what they called a reasonable cost. And at that time, as long as nursing homes were being paid a reasonable cost and we were making our cost coverage, rate equalization was a moot point. Whether it was private pay or MA, we were covering our costs. Since then, we were promised that that would not change, that the MA system would keep up with reasonable costs. But since then, the nursing home reimbursement systems have changed over the years, and we are no longer on a cost-based system. In the past 10 to 15 years, we've faced numerous rate freezes, and in the years where we actually did get a rate increase, we were severely restricted in how those rate increases could be applied within our facilities. Since the passage of rate equalization, there's only one other state, which is North Dakota, that has passed a similar law. If this was a good law, you would think that 48 other states in this nation would be considering using it in their states. We use our nursing homes differently today. In 1976, the patients were different. In 2011, they're much more medically complex, they are more debilitated, and they're more advanced with their cognitive impairments. The people we saw in 1976 are staying in their homes now. The people we saw 5 years ago are going to assisted livings. Some of them are even able to stay at home with additional services. People have choices in our communities. They are not coming to nursing homes until much later in their phase of aging. This has led to reduced lengths of stays in nursing homes. There are people who are concerned that if rate equalization happens, it would prematurely cause people to spend down their assets and qualify earlier for nursing homes. People don't stay in nursing homes for 5 years anymore.
Right.
People are staying in my nursing home for 96 days. 96 days, that's 3 months, not years. There are going to be people who want to argue that it's not fair for people to pay more for their care in a nursing home if they're private pay versus medical assistance. But there's nowhere else in our society where this is applied. There's no other healthcare setting, there is no retail setting that this standard applies to except nursing homes. It's not fair. It's not fair for the providers, and it's not fair for my employees. We are suffering as a result of this. The medical assistance rate has not kept up. We are $25 per day under our costs on average in our nursing homes, and that gap is impoverishing us. I will give you an example. Nurses, registered nurses, make $16 per hour more in a hospital than they make in our facilities. Our health care insurance is unaffordable for our employees, and they have figured it out. Our employees have figured out if they work less hours, they will be eligible for Minnesota Care. I have employees cutting their hours so they can get on the Minnesota Care program because we can't give them affordable health care. These are wrong incentives. These are wrong incentives, and rate equalization is helping lead that. There's other people that are going to argue that rate equalization is going to reduce the quality of care or somehow limit access to care for medical assistance residents. With the state of our economy, we've got a budget gap in the state of Minnesota. We've got a federal deficit of unprecedented levels. Providers are getting the cuts. Providers keep getting cuts from Medicare and Medicaid. Well, guess what that does? It cuts the quality of care, and it restricts access for everyone, not just medical assistance. It's going to hurt everyone. This is going to reduce our care. And in nursing homes, we're already impoverished. We have 14% of Minnesota nursing homes that are in financial crisis right now, 14%. Rate equalization may not even save these few facilities, but it can save others. 95% of our reimbursement is directly controlled by the government. By the government. The government is telling us how we can spend our money for private paying people. We don't control Target. We don't control what they're charging or Cub Foods. Why are we controlling the private market in nursing homes? Now, we all recognize that the government is not the answer for continued financing in long-term care, especially with the senior demographic that is going to grow at astronomical rates in the very near future. But phasing out rate equalization, it's one part of a solution that will help with reform in long-term care financing. I think the state needs to set policies that incent people to pay for their care if they can afford to pay for it. Right now, we have disincentives in our society where it's more lucrative for people to spend down or transfer their assets and have the medical assistance program pay for them. Combining a phase out of rate equalization with other reforms is going to help individuals to be more responsible in planning for their long-term care needs, and it's going to help solve some of the financing issues that we have with the medical assistance budget in our future years. Thank you. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Well, thank you, Mr. Backe. Ms. Backe, I think you did a very good job summarizing the situation out there with nursing homes, and really appreciate that. And actually, do you have that written down? You kind of did that just ad lib, but you probably don't have a copy of your testimony because that was very good, your facts and figures. I would like a copy of that, too. If I could ask a question, some of the arguments between the private pay and the current system right now is that there's going to be a disparity or a difference in care. Can you address that?
Do you know what? My nursing assistants don't walk in the room and ask, how do you pay for your care? They don't walk in and do that. They don't even know it. My nurses don't know it. The only people that know it are the business office. I don't even know who's private pay. and who's Medicaid. That is not the standard for care in Minnesota, and I don't know any provider who will tolerate that.
And Ms. Backe, what is the, you mentioned $25 per day per client, resident. Is that increasing? Where has that been in the last, what's it?
A few years ago when we implemented the new financing with the new reimbursement model, nursing homes actually did see some of that gap closing. But in the last 2 years where we've had a freeze, we're seeing the gap growing again. So it had dropped to about $20 a day. It's back up to $25.
Ms. Backe, do you see a projection on a further gap?
If the governor's proposal goes through, it's probably going to go up to $27 or $28.
Thank you, Ms. Backe. Any other questions? Senator Berkley.
Well, Madam Chair, just a comment, and that is that, you know, the nursing home care is one of the most expensive, if not the most expensive, long-term care service we provide. And it's one of the reasons that the government is such a large payer to the nursing home industry, because people can't afford to pay for it out of their pockets. They run out of money. And so I think we do need to be concerned about, you know, impoverishing our seniors, whether it is for 96 days or whether it is for 6 months or a year. And I don't believe that most of them are in a position to pay more than they pay today for nursing home care. I also know that there are other states in the nation that do have, you know, nursing homes that are Medicaid homes, and then they have nursing homes that are private pay homes because they're able to collect more from the private pay patient. And they're in a geographic area where they don't need to rely on any Medicaid patients for their revenue, and so then those patients have to go someplace farther away where they do get lesser care because the facility has lesser revenue. And I do think we do need to worry about that.
Ms. Backe?
Madam Chair, thank you. We have facilities in Minnesota that have opted out of the Medicaid program because of the losses they sustain. It is not untrue in Minnesota that you may find a few facilities that do not participate, but it is because the Medicaid reimbursement is so poor.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Berkley.
Madam Chair, that is not an adequate answer. I'm sorry. How many have opted out of the Medicaid program in the last 5 years? I mean, we have a number of facilities, a handful, probably less than five, who are not in the Medicaid program because they chose not to be in the Medicaid program dozens and dozens of years ago. It was a decision they made. There were some that went out of the Medicaid program and they wanted back in later, but we have not had a large number of facilities that have left the Medicaid program in recent years.
Senator Berkland, I do think, though, in this situation, the Medicaid population is changing. The resident or the client in the nursing home is changing. Like Ms. Backe said, the number of days that they stay there is changing. If you do opt out for a Medicaid program, it's a lot of times because of the federal regulations that are put on these nursing homes also. And so this is an option. And out in greater Minnesota, you aren't going to have a private pay home or resident and a MA home. You're just not going to do that. So, Ms. Backe, do you have anything to?
No, there have been two facilities that I'm aware of that have opted out of Medicaid, but both of them are in urban markets. That does not happen in the rural market. There's not enough of a private paying base in order to support that.
Senator Hayne?
Madam Chair, as far as I know, I think we have some other people that may be here to offer some comment or answer some questions, but I understand there's some other testifiers who want to voice their views, and I think Ms. Sabaki needs to travel back somewhere, and so I don't want to keep her any longer than she can stay.
Questions for Ms. Backe? Thank you, Ms. Backe, for coming down. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Senator Hand.
Madam Chair, I know from the list there are some folks that have indicated a desire to testify. So
okay, Ms. Allen? Gina Allen? Oh, and also Ms. Kimball also, please, if you could come. Thank you. Please testify or mention your name for the records.
I'm Michelle Kimball. I'm the Senior State Director for AARP here in Minnesota.
Ms. Kimball.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The previous testifier referenced people who will tell you that people will spend down faster, that this will cost the state more, that it could result in a lower quality of care. We are those people. I will read my prepared testimony, but before I do want to say that we do agree that nursing homes should be paid adequately, and staff in particular should be paid adequately in order to provide the best quality care for their residents and those individuals that we are here to speak for today. But we do not believe, and there are others behind us who also do not believe, that repealing rate equalization is going to be the answer to adequate pay for nursing facilities and for staffing. So having said that, I do want to say that I do appreciate the opportunity to testify before you today. We are opposed to Senate File 731, and we do believe that this proposal will force nursing home residents who pay their own way to pay more, resulting in a significant cost shift, a tax on people who have done the right thing and saved their entire lives and pay for their own care out of pocket. By 2014, nursing homes would be able to charge anything they wanted. It could be twice, three, four times the amount of the Medicaid rate. And that would not even guarantee better quality of care. There's no guarantees in this legislation that would require nursing homes to provide a better quality of care for the amount of money that they would be charging private pay residents. Rate equalization was actually first established back in the 1970s to help prevent indiscrimination of care, and it's ensured that private pay residents pay their own way for as long as possible without having to utilize state tax dollars to do so, scarce public dollars. In fact, we believe that the large cost shift would result in not only costing individuals more, but it will result in the state paying more because people will, in fact, spend down faster. And while the current fiscal note does not show any cost to the state through 2015, it doesn't indicate what the cost will be beyond 2015. And I would note, I would kind of question that at this moment. I would note, although it was a different piece of legislation, a similar proposal in the House, in 2006 did result in a fiscal note of $9.3 million in 2009. So I would be cautious about that. Furthermore, I do want to bring to the committee's attention that there was a survey that was done here in Minnesota in December of 2010 in conjunction with the University of Minnesota Center for Survey Research, and we asked Minnesota consumers of all ages how they would feel about repealing the rate equalization law that is unique here in Minnesota. And the results were very clear. 86% of respondents support maintaining rate equalization, and that is across all ages, across all incomes, and across all party lines. I know that you have all been working hard to minimize cuts to nursing homes, and we do support these efforts. And it is important to remember, however, that repealing rate equalization does not ensure fiscal stability for nursing homes, nor does it address the budget issues that are facing facilities that have a majority of MA residents. And in other states without rate equalization, nursing homes continue to lobby their legislators for more money. You have heard the argument that we're only one of two states with the rate equalization law. No one else does it, so why should we? We should because it works, and we have some of the best quality in the country. Minnesota has always been a leader. So I ask you, why should we bring ourselves down to the level of other states? AARP urges you to reject the repeal of rate equalization and instead find a balanced approach to the budget that allows us to, at a minimum, maintain what we currently have until we can address the bigger, more systemic problems in our long-term care system. And in fact, I would urge you to consider reforming the long-term care system and the way that we finance long-term care, because we cannot continue in the same manner that we have been going and continue to provide quality care and continue to adequately fund nursing facilities as well as home and community-based services. And with that, I would like to turn it over to one of our key volunteers, Karina Allen.
Ms. Kimball, I have a question for you.
I'm a volunteer
for
AARP.
Excuse me, one second. I have a question for Ms. Allen or Ms. Kimball.
Yes.
If you're not, if AARP is not in favor of the rate equalization and you are talking about reform to help mitigate some of these expenses and the difference between MA and what the cost of a client is per day, what is your suggestion besides pouring more money into the nursing homes and long-term care? Because everybody around this table wants to see our long-term care facilities sustainable and whole. But what is your solution? What do you suggest?
Well, actually, I've been working with the industry and with other stakeholders in the state on long-term care redesign for a number of years. We are very close to offering something. I do not have it in front of me at this point, nor am I able to present it to you at this time. One of the solutions we have talked about, or that could be of help, let me back up and just say one of the important things we need to do is redesign the delivery of care. We need to provide care in a manner that people truly want it and how they want it. In Minnesota, we've done a good job of rebalancing long-term care by providing greater resources for home and community-based care where people want to stay when they need long-term care. I think we can do a better job of that. One of the ideas that are on the table right now at the national level is incorporating long-term care into medical homes. In Minnesota, we have created a medical home for acute care. And integrating long-term care with acute care in a medical home could be one way that we could improve delivery and reduce costs. So that is something that I would suggest. But I would also say that there are a number of stakeholders that we are working together with to look at an improved way of delivering long-term care. There has been studies that have recently been done looking at long-term care financing. There's more to do on that. But I think we are on our way to helping the legislature identify ways in which we can improve the delivery of long-term care and improve the financing and encourage more people to begin saving for long-term care at the same time that they are preparing for retirement. And we will be at the forefront of that education. One of our problems we have is that we do not have adequate private insurance that is affordable and provides the coverage that people truly want and need, yet available. The CLASS Act that was just part of healthcare reform is a start, but it doesn't go far enough. So there are a number of problems that can be addressed, and there are a number of solutions that people are looking at, and I would be very happy to continue this discussion moving forward with concrete solutions.
I'm Karina Allen. Are you through?
Hi, Ms. Allen. Thank you.
I'm a
volunteer. Welcome to the committee.
I beg your pardon?
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I'm a volunteer for AARP. I'm not a paid lobbyist. I'm a senior that has many times in the past been lobbying here on health care issues, especially in long-term care. I started in the late 70s lobbying for home health care. In my second career, I served as a social work consultant in a nursing home. I go back a long way in the medical. I worked in four Army hospitals during the Second World War. I've worked in four civilian hospitals. The nursing home rate equalization was one of the many laws that improved nursing home care in Minnesota. The main reason for passing the nursing home equalization law was simple. As a state, we do not want a two-tiered health care system. It is difficult to get equally good health care for all nursing home residents when one group pays more. I think all we have to do is look at the English system. They have a two-tiered. You can go to private hospital or you can use the one through the health service. Most of Europe doesn't have it, and they have better systems. England has one of the poorest. Before nursing home rate equalization, most of the good nursing homes had two lists. If a medical assistant patient needed a bed, most good homes did not have a bed available immediately. However, if the person needing a bed was a private pay, there was always a bed available. Of course, the intake worker was told they were to deny that there was a list. When a medical assistant resident left a nursing home for a temporary hospital stay, there often was no longer a bed available when they were to return back to the home. Sometimes patients had to be kept in the hospital longer because it was difficult to find a medical assistance bed. That's a pretty expensive thing. Many medical assistance patients are people from our middle class who have run out of money paying for their nursing home care. It is hard for them and very cruel of us to then force them to adjust to poor care. The people affected the most are not the wealthy. The very rich usually hire aides or nurses and around the clock, if necessary, when they stay at home after they have been in the hospital. After the nursing home rate equalization was passed, the poor nursing homes disappeared and the good homes multiplied because they were paid just as much to take care of medical assistance patients in private. Let's not kill a bill that helped make our nursing homes so good. And I'd be happy to answer questions. I'd like to make a few comments on what the young lady said. She mentioned that the nurses did not know whether they were medical assistants or not. The nurse has to fill out the slip, and medical assistance pays for you going to a doctor. The nurse has to know who is the medical assistant patient so they can fill out that slip for them. Nursing homes, we used to have a little more control over the cost. That was Rule 50. I thought it was very good. It was the nursing homes that asked to get rid of that and go on this other where they didn't have to bring in a survey, an audit, as to their costs. And the costs were broken down into five groups. That is nursing, food, ancillary care, administration, and administration could only be 15%. There will be more on medical assistance. I have a brother-in-law who was a doctor over in Wisconsin now, and he has had Alzheimer's for almost 20 years. He is just about ready to go on medical assistance. He had a wealthy practice, but there's a limit. Wisconsin charges about 40% more than Minnesota. After all, they can set their rates at what they want to. I think that's it. If you have more questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you, Ms. Allen. Senator Berglund.
So, Ms. Allen, what you're saying to us is, even though in a rural area of the state, the nursing home might not be declared themselves not accepting Medicaid, if they only have one bed and they have two or three people asking for that bed, you're saying the person on medical assistance would be less likely to get that bed, and they would have to wait to get a bed.
Very definitely. In fact, I'll go a little further. At one time, Ramsey County, in order to save more money, was sending, this was before we had equalization, were sending people over to Wisconsin because they were lower paid at that time. But they sent them over there. So in other words, we can move them to cheaper states, too. Well, you know, that residency thing doesn't count. We've tried to have rules because snowbirds, for instance, are my brother-in-law, who had quite a wealthy practice, found that people that go down to Florida and Arizona, where they have very poor nursing homes, they would call and want to come back up here when they had to go to a nursing home. They didn't want to be down there. Now, if we could do something about that, we could probably save quite a bit of money.
Mm-hmm. Senator Hahn, just a response to you, if you could answer this question, that if you thought that your bill would stop or eliminate any of this redesign, the care, delivery of care, or any of the momentum that's going on that Ms. Kimball was talking. Do you think they could run succinctly?
Madam Chair, thank you. I appreciated her comments. There's many things that she is talking about that I certainly agree with, embrace. I'm sure many others do. I believe that we do need to reform our long-term care structure in Minnesota. I don't think anything in this bill precludes that. I think that we do have a problem currently. I have a very good friend, someone that I've known for years and years, a member of our church. He happens to be the president of Elim Care, which is a business that operates nursing homes around in Minnesota and other states. He's talked to me about this issue for years and wondering why Minnesota, among other places where his company does business, is unique in this respect. And I think his judgment is correct, that there hasn't been some of the things that we're hearing about, the terrible things that will happen. I don't believe that is happening in other places. I don't believe that people are being mistreated in other states. But I do think that in the short term, as we struggle with our budget and as we look at how we can continue to provide the care and make the commitments and meet the commitments that we've made, we have to find some ways to help nursing facilities pay for their costs. And I think doing away with the rate equalization structure allows that to happen. I think in the interim, we can continue to find and work on other solutions that might strengthen the entire system, and I certainly favor those things. So it's not that I'm saying that this is a solution to the long-term care issues that we face, but I think it is a solution to help us bridge the gap between where we are today and perhaps where we need to get to a few years down the road.
Thank you, Senator.
Madam Chair.
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair, you know, I think we all need to be a little bit careful when we use the term their costs, because the cost of nursing home care today is a direct result of the amount of revenue available to a nursing home. Nobody is going out and taking a loan from a bank for their operating costs. This bank wouldn't give them one. So when we say that, all it means is somebody else is paying more to a nursing home than Medicaid is. And in this case, today, it's Medicare, another government program. But if your bill goes through, Senator Hahn, the nursing home's going to be able to decide how much their highest payer is going to pay. And to some extent, people in that community are going to be hostage to whatever that decision is. And I don't know about your community, but in my community, people have lost money on their pensions because of the economy. Social Security is not going up. People don't have the money to pay somebody else whatever that person decides the market will bear. This is not like a free enterprise system we have with nursing homes. You know, it isn't like you can choose from A, B, C, or D in your community and they're all competing for your business. It isn't the way it works. Usually you have one If you're in the metro area, maybe you have two in your community, and you got to pick from one of those.
Ms.
Allen.
Excuse me. Medicare does set they have you have to have so many nurses for so many patients, and medical assistance does not. And we, during the time I was working, we did have special floors for medical assistance patients. Some had part of one floor medical assistance. And often that was referred to as going to the dump.
I would just like to make a comment on that, Ms. Allen, because I do serve 14 different nursing homes, and I am very close with all those administrators. They work very hard, and all the people that work in those nursing homes work very hard, and I almost take offense to that because I don't think there's anybody that's going to the dump on that. I also would like to just mention, too, that the nursing home patient and your first testifier, Senator Hand, brushed on this. They are different. The client is different nowadays that's coming in. They're coming in for a short term. In the past, in the 70s and 80s, they used to come in and they'd leave their car, and that was the place where they would end up dying is in the nursing home. It's a completely different scenario now. So they're coming in for just some immediate care, maybe going back out. It's, like I said, the average day is, approximate stay is like 96 days or so. So it's completely different. And if somebody wants to pay a private pay, I think they should have that option. So I appreciate the work that ARP is doing on this, and I hope you continue to work in this reform and redesigning the system. Final comment, Ms. Kimball?
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you very much. I, too, have traveled the state with the head of aging services, and I've visited our nursing homes. I've had an opportunity to talk to administrators. I've had an opportunity to talk to staff, and I've had the opportunity to speak with patients. And I do know that administrators, staff, very hardworking. They are doing their very, very best, and they do need additional funding in order to provide the best quality care. Absolutely. I do also want to bring to the chair's and the committee's attention that with these shorter stays, I believe roughly 96 days was indicated. 90 of those days can be covered by Medicare if that individual was released from a hospital and is Medicare eligible. Given that a lot of that cost may be covered by Medicare, I would raise the question of how helpful repealing rate equalization might be to a given home, if it would in fact really provide the additional costs or the additional dollars they truly need to be fully operational and maintain their staff and pay their staff adequately. I would just raise the notion that what really needs to perhaps occur is to increase the Medicaid rate, which is one of the lowest in the country. And by increasing the Medicaid rate, you do, in fact, increase the private pay rate. And I will leave it at that. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any further questions?
I'd like to make another comment.
Ms. Allen.
And that is that the turnover in the nursing home, there are some wonderful people. I've known a lot of them. But they don't stay long. The turnover is very high because the pay isn't good.
Right. Absolutely.
But,
thank you.
I don't think that putting a, this is like putting a sick tax on a sick person. Why does the person who is sick so often have to pay for the one who can't pay? Why aren't we people who are wealthy, wealthy enough to pay a little more in tax? We should be the ones.
Senator Hoffman and then Senator Brickman.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to go back to a comment. I started my career in a nursing home. Mm-hmm. I didn't know who paid what. And in my ER, I didn't know who paid and who didn't pay, but I gave the same care to every patient that I looked down on. And so I, along with Senator Rose, I'm a little offended about the dumping ground. I've never looked at one patient any different than another, no matter how what their ability to pay was. So, and I represent a number of nursing homes that are struggling because of not being able to equal, not to be, because of this law. And if we don't do something about this soon, my nursing homes in rural Minnesota will not be in existence. And that's where I started my career. And so these are some of the things that we need to do along with the reforms. I welcome AARP with the reforms. We absolutely need them. But my nursing homes are in serious trouble right now. And some of them are actually lower compensated because of where they're located than what the numbers are showing right now. So I appreciate where you were in the 70s, but that's not where we are now.
Ms. Allen, excuse me, Senator Berkley.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. So what I wanted to say is that, you know, the majority of short stay patients aren't there 96 days. They're there less than 30 days. I would say probably an average of 20 days.
2 weeks.
And the nursing home will have maybe one floor that's doing rehab for short stays. Mm-hmm. And they got two floors of people that are staying there a long time. And so, you know, the idea that somehow this isn't going to affect very many people because everybody's a short stay resident, I just don't think that's really accurate. There are still a lot of people that end their life in a nursing home because they do not have an alternative that fits their needs, or they are not able to get enough family support in combination with an alternative to meet their needs. And so we're still going to have a lot of people, if this law goes through, that are going to be spending down because of increased charges to a nursing home faster than they would have otherwise.
Thank you, Senator Berkland. Thank you, Ms. Kimball and Ms. Allen. Senator Sharon, I didn't see you.
I have so many things I could say. First of all, I think that I have not heard anybody in any place, at any table, from any perspective, disagree that there's an enormous stress on nursing homes to be able to provide care and to pay their employees a reasonable wage and give them cost of living raises. So I, you know, to me that's off the table. Everybody agrees there's a great deal of stress on these facilities. For me, the issue is whether or not this is the correct solution. And I think that it's one that has come to the table because the legislature has not been willing to consider an alternative, a number of alternative solutions. One that we did last year that I think has potential, it's a reform bill that is called PACE that allows nursing homes to become PACE providers and negotiate for rates based on total cost of care. That's an absolutely positive way in which we can begin through some pilots to see whether or not we can impact the cost of long-term care. But the other point that I think I want to raise from the testifiers is that there is an alternative that the majority may not want to pursue, but it is to have these services funded out of a broader tax, a general tax, out of the general fund, in which we collect more revenue on a progressive basis for all taxpayers in the state of Minnesota, rather than using only programs like this rate equalization that drives those who have some resources that have saved them into poverty faster at the end of life, at the end of their careers, when they don't have as much time to recapture that in the workplace. And that's why I'm opposed to this, not because I don't think there is enormous stress, not that I think that nurses don't give great care to whomever come in front of them. I think that they do most of the time. I'm just not sure about administrators. But because I think it's the wrong solution. It's one that is coming to us from the long-term care industry because they're so frustrated with the inability to get their rates increased, which is the proper way to address this issue and to properly fund that through the proper forms of taxation. and this is not the right way to solve this problem. It gives relief in the short term, but it has a long-term consequence. There's much better solutions that are more responsible than this, I believe, for the legislature.
Another, I'd like to clear remarks.
Excuse me. Ms. Allen.
Okay, thank you. When I said dump, that doesn't mean that the people working there aren't working harder and that they don't love those patients. They do very, very much. I chose to work in county hospitals like Hennepin County Medical Center, University Hospital. I had bone marrow transplants. I chose to be with those. It's been my life's work. I feel very sorry for the people there. You run your legs off, but you just, there is a limit to how much you can do. I swear, I think that the aides in the nursing homes have the largest bladders in town because you just don't have time. These things need to be done, and you want it done, and you want to do it in a nice way. But I agree so much with you, Senator, that it's for the rest of us to help rather than putting it all on the poor. I've been very lucky that I'm as old as I am and still have the health that I have. I feel very blessed.
Ms. Allen, you look in good shape. From here, you look great.
Thank you
for coming to the committee.
Close to 90,
that.
But I'm
oh,
still
no kidding.
Going there.
Good for you. Ms. Kimball, anything? Any other questions? Thank you very much for coming, Ms. Kimball, Ms. Allen. Ms. Oshri Mauzitz. Was that close?
Okramovitz.
And Mr. Okramovitz. McAbee, please. I am so sorry.
No, that's fine. I thought you actually did a pretty credible job, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jane Okramovich. This is an aside, but the hearing on Thursday with Representative Abler chairing, he didn't even attempt it, Madam Chair. He said, could I just have Jane O'Connell, please, on it? And of course, there are jokes about that that I could tell as well. But good evening, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Jane Okramovich. I am a senior also, and I am a volunteer advocate who currently serves as the president of the Seniors and Workers for Quality Care Coalition. We are the people at the heart of long-term care. I became involved in the issues of long-term care originally because of my mother, who died of Alzheimer's disease in 2005 after being in a nursing home for 8 years. But I'm now concerned because these issues impact me a bit more directly, I'm afraid. As a representative of all of the members of the Seniors and Workers for Quality Care Coalition, I testify tonight about the inequity that we see in Senate File 731, the proposed repeal of rate equalization in the state of Minnesota. Unfortunately, repealing the state's rate equalization law won't prevent nursing homes from experiencing financial hardship. Homes all over the United States, even in those homes in the 48 states that allow homes to charge private pay residents more, are closing. The reasons for closure are far more complex than the existence of rate equalization. Of greatest concern to us in eliminating rate equalization is the looming possibility that nursing homes will pick and choose from the waiting list for admission and based on the ability to pay. As you've heard from previous testimony tonight, and because of the current non-discrimination law that exists in this rate equalization law, it is the protector of those whose funds have been drained, often due to the expense that's associated with a chronic disease. And as the law currently stands, it ensures appropriate care for all residents of homes, not just those who have the private pay funds to pay for it. In most states without private pay regularization, as you've heard, there is a two-tiered system that exists. It may not be a separate home. It may not be the private pay. It may be a separate wing or a separate floor. It really, unfortunately, hurts the residents who deserve good quality care, and no matter what the payer source is, and also the workers who deserve decent working conditions and wages for the hard work they do. I have with me tonight Mr. McAvey, who is a spousal caregiver. He will offer just his personal account of the importance to rate equalization to him and his family, and then if I could have just a few moments of closing comments after that. I do need to make a correction on the agenda. Mr. McAvey's name is spelled incorrectly. Some of you may have known his son because he was around here for a long while, and that was Mark McAvey. So it's M-C-A-F-E-E is the correct spelling on his last name. Mr. McAvey?
Welcome, Mr. McAvey, to the committee.
Chair, everybody. My name is Al McAfee. 32 years I was a high school teacher and later a small business owner. My wife Alice was a legal secretary. She then became an accountant, and she finally ended up in a federal program as a federal program officer. We saved our money and we weren't frugal. But we saved our money, and we didn't spend on extravagances. Our three-bedroom Rambler was bought on the GI Bill. And we raised two children. One was Mark and Sue. And we enjoyed our life in Roseville. Alice, my wife, was diagnosed with dementia in 2004. And I took care of her home. It just got worse and worse, and I took care of her for 2 years and had to help her in many ways. When things got bad, when we decided, my daughter and I and son, to get her into a nursing home, we chose Presbyterian Homes in Arden Hills. Sorry about that. So she's been there 4 years, and she seems to enjoy our care there. I usually feed her twice a day. She can't feed herself. She can stand with the aid of a lifter, and she can be taken care of by one aide. I go up there twice a day, and I feed her, and I also help other people. I cut their food and talk to them, wheel them around. And besides, I know all the residents' assistants. I know most of the residents. And I know them by name, as well as the staff managers. And being a former teacher of management, I always, first week I was there, I can run this place better than that. And then I started to look at both sides of the thing. And then I finally realized it's a pretty well-run place. We didn't qualify for medical assistance because we had saved our money. We had IRAs, and we had mutual funds, and we had some stock. Some of them, just by luck, they doubled. And so we didn't qualify. But we had long-term insurance taken out about 15 years ago. And at the time we took the long-term out, we didn't realize what the cost would be. So now, I'll give you a little on the cost. The long-term care only pays for about a third of it, what we have. So if you could plan ahead. But the cost was, it's about $2,000 a year for the cost. And for the nursing home cost, it's about $6,700 a month. And we get $2,700 from the long-term care. So I have to come up with $4,000. Now, it varies each month, but I have to come up with $4,000 a month. And then I tell this to other people, and they look at me, and they say, how do you do that? Well, you do it. You take out, you cash in some of your CDs, and you use your Social Security. When my wife and I retired, we saved our Social Security checks. That did help in this. But I thought most people saved their money. So I'm asking you, what are you going to do? I mean, you're going to spend down right now and live high? What? You must have some assets. What are you going to do with it? And I thought most people, and I guess I was wrong, I don't know. We saved, well, we lived good. We went to Europe twice. We traveled all over. We did a lot of stuff. So what's wrong with what I did? Would somebody tell me? I'm 85, and I'm in good health, but I have to worry about this thing we're going to talk about here. We've been talking about it, raising our rates and making things unfair. Well, that you can see my side, too. Equalization, I don't think it should stay. It must stay. I'm not rich, and I don't think of me as that. Think about yourselves and other families. What kind of situations will you leave them? So we spin down? Is that what we do? Put everybody on Medicare and Medicaid? Thank you for letting me.
Thank you, Mr. McAvee. Thank you very
much. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a few more brief comments. Thank you. An additional concern for our coalition is that the supposed increased revenue that this repeal will bring temporarily does not mean a stable, well-trained staff. And I think you heard that this evening. That the staff that's needed to provide much-needed care in the facilities. There is nothing in the bill that assures that the direct care worker will benefit from its repeal or that we will have adequate staff in these facilities. Furthermore, the reality is that many nursing homes, particularly in our metro area, will see little increase in revenue as many of their residents already are on medical assistance. And that may be true of Greater Minnesota as well. I'm not sure the percentage because it varies in each facility. At any rate, they'll be private pay when they enter a facility, and again, who knows how long they would continue to be able to be private pay. And how long will that family be able to pay for it once the rate is increased? Mr. McAvee demonstrated how costly nursing home placement is already, and of course, it's only going to rise as her level of care increases as she deteriorates more. I had the opportunity to communicate with the nursing home administrator in Greater Minnesota when he wrote last year to tell his industry association that the repeal of rate equalization was not a good answer, as has been stated by a few people this evening, to the problem of inadequate reimbursement. And I have the permission to share his position on this. He's saying the problem is, you know, across the board, the inadequate reimbursement that is being given to facilities, whether it's medical assistance or private pay. And even his board of directors passed a resolution in that regard. I thank you for the opportunity to address the committee and also to express our deep concerns about the elimination of this hard-fought-for protection of all those who reside in nursing homes. And please permit us to be part of continuing in the conversation on solving the disparity in rate reimbursement. I thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Jane.
Thank you.
Are there any questions? Thank you very much, Mr. McAvee and Ms. Jane. Senator Han.
Madam Chair, I'm not sure
comments?
If there's other testifiers on the list.
Anybody in the audience that would like to come testify? There is no more on the list.
If not, I know there are some folks here from the Long-Term Care Imperative. I'd like to at least invite them if they wish to make some comments. They have been involved in working on this bill. And if they are interested, I think. I'd like
Absolutely.
To come make some comments. I appreciate that.
Who's going first?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Carrie Thurlow. I work with Aging Services of Minnesota, and I'm here on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. honestly, I think our testifier this evening, Ms. Bakke, summarized our support for the bill, and we just want to thank Senator Han for bringing this bill forward. The imperative does support this bill. We'd be happy to answer any additional questions that may arise since Ms. Bakke had to return back to St. Cloud. We'd be happy to answer any questions, and I guess I'll just leave my statement at that and see if Mr. Pearson, my counterpart, has anything to add. Mr. Pearson.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Toby Pearson. I'm with the Care Providers of Minnesota, and like Carrie said, I think our testifier said it all for us, and we're just here to answer any questions.
I do have a question for either one of you. The federal law now addresses this Medicaid discrimination. Can you explain a little bit about that? That is one of your initiatives, and we should talk about that because I think that is very important to our discussion.
Madam Chair, members, it was raised a number of times about the Medicaid discrimination and the fact that it didn't actually exist in 1976, but in fact it did get handled on the federal level, and now there's the equal access to quality care provision that states that a facility must establish and maintain identical policies and practices regarding transfer, discharge, and the provision of services under the state plan for all individuals regardless of source of payment. I do believe that that did not exist at the time that rate equalization was put in, but in subsequent acts it has been addressed on the federal level as well.
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair, thank you. Transfer and discharge is not the same as admission. So I'm presuming, based on what you just read to us, that you could still make a determination on admission of preferring one customer over another.
Ms. Thurlow?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we will check the federal law. Our understanding is that the federal law also prohibits discrimination based on payer source, but we will, if we can check that and get back in writing with a response to that, we'd be happy to do so.
That would be very helpful. Thank you. Thank you, Senator Berglund. Is there any other questions for the two? Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Any further discussion on the bill? Okay, Senator Han, your preference is to just lay it over?
Madam Chair and members, yes, I would like to ask that this bill be laid over for consideration in our final bill.
Okay, thank you very much, Senator Han.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair, Senator Han, why would you do that? This bill that we saw tonight shows a fiscal note of no cost. So why would you want to put something as controversial as this in an omnibus bill that you're going to have a lot of difficulty with anyway, rather than sending it out on its own?
Senator Han.
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, I anticipate that much of what we will do will not be without some controversy. We know that we're going to have a difficult job. The governor has a different approach to solving the budget than we do. We understand that. What we're trying to do is put together a package of budget proposals as well as some policy proposals that we think could impact the budget. Part of what we're trying to get at, we hope, are some at least directions for reform. I think long-term care reform is important. I believe that putting this in the bill is at least, in my view, an indication that we need to do some things to try to reform the system generally. I think no one believes this is a solution, but it certainly could be part of whatever we are going to have to go forward with. I don't frankly believe that we should have a restriction on private pay in Minnesota.
Madam Chair.
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Senator Han, I believe you. You wouldn't be sitting on the at that side of the table presenting this bill if you didn't believe the bill was a good bill. That is not a reason to put it in an omnibus bill. You know, I just still say this. I know it probably doesn't matter, but, you know, I've had quite a few years with conference committees and omnibus bills. My advice is, whether you agree with a policy or disagree with a policy that is controversial, don't put it in your omnibus bill if it doesn't have any money attached to it. And I can guarantee you there were things that I agreed with, and I refused to put it in my omnibus bill because I knew there were others who disagreed with it, and it was going to just make it that much harder to get to yes in the end. And, Madam Chair, I guess if this is a motion, I would like a roll call vote on it because I would like to be recorded as voting against this and not just voting against a budget bill in general.
Madam Chair, I'm not making a motion. I'm just asking for it to be laid over for consideration. So I'm not making a motion.
No motion,
to
Senator. Anything. Thank you, Senator Hanna.
Thank you.
We doing this? Senator Fischbach. Senate File 695. Establishing the Human Cloning Prohibition Act.
Senator Fischbach, thank you for your patience. I know we had you earlier on the schedule. I apologize. We had some other testifiers that wanted to make their testimony and depart, so I appreciate your patience. And please, I understand you have an amendment you'd like to offer.
Yes, if that's so I will move Senate File 695, but I do have an author's amendment, which is, let me make sure, it is the A2, since this is my first hearing.
Senator Rosen moves the A2. I'm sorry.
I can
do
move
that.
It.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
And I'll move the A2 amendment.
All right. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. The A2 amendment is adopted.
And basically, Senate File 695, it makes human cloning unlawful in the state of Minnesota. And what the A2 amendment did was, first of all, take out that subdivision 1 where it names the bill, the Human Cloning Prohibition Act of 2011. And then the next section basically defines human cloning and what we are looking at in the bill. And then the next section describes the prohibition of cloning or on cloning. And subdivision 5 on page 2 clarifies what procedures are addressed so that we are addressed by the bill, so that is very clear what we are getting at, which is human cloning. Under subdivision 6, it does say on 2.9, it was a felony, and the A2 amendment changed that. It deleted felony and changed it to a misdemeanor. And then on lines 213, we added the 500 in the A2 amendment, just so that you know that's you can engross it as we go along. And then finally, the last section there is the severability clause, which is pretty typical language. If any of the portions of the legislation is struck down, that the others would remain. And basically, you know, we have right now in Minnesota, 2009, we passed a ban on funding of human cloning. And so this is just the next step to make human cloning illegal in the state of Minnesota or unlawful. And there are at least 6 states that have that have this type of ban in place. And there are about a dozen that have some kind of ban like that in place or some part of a human cloning ban. And there's at least 40 countries that have banned human cloning, and the UN has a document that would ban human cloning. And just to remind you, this bill, I know that there was a piece of something handed out from the U of M that talks about this is the first step, the only first step towards embryonic stem cell. The only thing that this bans is human cloning. We're very, very careful about the language in the bill, and actually in portions of it clarify that. So I would appreciate your support on 695 as amended.
Are there questions from the committee?
I do believe, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but I do believe there is someone who wanted to testify too. So I don't.
I understand, Senator Fischbach, that yes, a testifier is on her way.
Okay,
we'll
thank you.
We'll be here shortly. Senator Rosen.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Then we have time for a story.
Awesome.
And
Jalice. Kind of lean back.
Yeah, sit down, relax, because this is
this is a great story. Hopefully you'll enjoy it as much as I did. I own a bunch of prize rodeo bulls, and they are kept up in Mandan, North Dakota. And one of them is Yellow Jacket Jr., or excuse me, Yellow Jacket. Little Yellow Jacket, excuse me, that's his name. And I have Little Yellow Jacket Jr. also. But anyway, Little Yellow Jacket Jr. has won the world finals 3 years in a row. And Senator Sharon knows exactly what I'm talking about because she has seen my bulls with me. And that was a very fun trip. But anyway, they took Little Yellow Jacket Jr. and cloned him. They took him all the way down to Austin, Texas, clipped his ear, and cloned him. So I'm at the ranch in Mandan, North Dakota, and I'm looking at three of his clones. And I'm going to tell you, that is pretty weird. Because they're standing. They were standing exactly apart. They were looking the same. They had the same stance, exactly the same as little Yellow Jacket Jr. And it was spooky to see that. So that's my story. I'm sticking to it. But I looked to Joe Berger, who is the owner of little Yellow Jacket Jr., and I said, what do you think of this? And he goes, it's kind of creepy. It's creepy. He's about 78, but... See, it was just, if you've never seen anything cloned, and to see it up close like that is pretty weird, I'm telling you. So anyway, that's my story. Thank you.
Very interesting. I think that would be probably unnerving a little bit, especially when you're talking about a rodeo bull. I understand they're pretty good size.
Yeah, well, these were only yearlings, Mr. Chair, but and the debate is, are they going to be as great as their dad? Well, they have to have the same environmental situation and some of the same issues that have been approached to them, weather conditions, all that type of thing. I would assume is going to make the character of a bull. But these are pretty big philosophical questions that you're dealing with. But just to see something cloned like that up close and personal. And just kind of walked away. That's all I'm going to say.
Thank you. And it looks like we have Ms. Rao here.
Thank you. And fill the space
Mr.
in.
Mr. Chair, can I just say, Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, Senator thank Fishbach. You for the story. And
yeah.
I think just what I'll stick out in my mind for the rest of my life is it's just kind of creepy. That look on your face.
Just kind of creepy.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Go ahead.
It's all right. So, Ms. Rao.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Andrea Rao, and I am here representing Minnesota Citizens Concerned for Life. MCCL is a grassroots organization representing more than 70,000 individual donors, and we have more than 240 chapters across the state of Minnesota. We are dedicated to the single issue of protecting innocent human life. I'm here today to urge you to pass Senate File 695, the Human Cloning Prohibition Act. In 2009, Minnesota passed a two-year prohibition on state funding of human cloning. Therefore, the state already has made clear that it does not support or encourage human cloning. This bill just takes the next logical step and prohibits cloning throughout the state and not just the funding of it with tax dollars. Everyone in this room knows what human cloning is. Maybe not the scientific terms or exactly how to go about it, but what the end result of the action is. Simply put, human cloning is making a genetic copy of another human. Researchers and the scientific community had always called it cloning, but when polls came out showing strong opposition to human cloning, they started using other more scientific terms. Things like nuclear transfer, somatic cell nuclear transfer, or transplantation, or simply SCNT. But don't be confused. All of those terms mean cloning. A 2010 Gallup poll showed that 88% of Americans believe that human cloning is morally wrong. And this poll isn't unique. Poll after poll has shown overwhelming opposition to human cloning in the United States. And the American people are not the only ones rejecting human cloning. Banning human cloning would put Minnesota in good company. States like North Dakota, Iowa, Michigan, South Dakota, and others have banned human cloning. And nearly 40 countries prohibit human cloning as well, including Germany, France, and Canada, to name a few. In 2005, the United Nations adopted the UN Declaration on Human Cloning, which called upon member states to adopt all measures necessary to prohibit all forms of human cloning inasmuch as they are incompatible with human dignity and the protection of life. Researchers in America and around the globe are rejecting human cloning and are turning to other forms of research that are both ethical and more successful. Consider, for example, Rudolf Janisch, a world-renowned scientist and professor at MIT. He has been recognized as a leader in the field of cloning. However, in an interview published earlier this month, Janisch said, 10 years ago, we talked about the potential of nuclear transfer, remember that's cloning, for therapy. But it turns out the technique was of no practical relevance. You would never do it in humans for a number of reasons. First, it's very inefficient. With mice, that doesn't matter because we can do hundreds of transfers to get a few mice. But human cloning is another order of magnitude more difficult than in mice. And people can't even get the eggs to practice on. A colleague told me that he got a couple of human nuclear transfers going, but they all arrested at the 6 or 8 cell stage. So there's something we don't understand going on in human embryos. With nuclear transfer, you never get normal embryos. I urge you today to listen to the vast majority of Americans who believe that human cloning is wrong and to vote today to ban human cloning in Minnesota. Please support Senate File 695. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Rao. There are questions from the committee.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Did Ms. Rao hear my story?
Did Ms. Rao hear your story?
I'm just joking. That was a joke.
I heard the
did you want to tell it again?
No, can I tell it again? No. It's a joke.
Well, Mr. Chair, if you would entertain it, if there's no questions, I will renew my
Senator
motion.
Marty has a question.
I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, Senator Fischbach, my question is, who is talking about doing human cloning? I mean, I don't know. I just see this thing here from the University of Minnesota, and I'm wondering. I mean, I can't picture anybody but the university having the capacity to do anything that might resemble human cloning and so on. And I guess I do think that some of the stem cell research is what. I mean, that's what my concern is, the stem cell research. I don't want anybody to do cloning, but I haven't seen anybody talking about it or thinking about it either here or anywhere, basically. I guess the question is, what are we fixing? Do you think it's going to happen if we don't pass a bill?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Marty, I think that makes our decision very easy, that if we don't want to see it, then we pass this bill just to make sure that it is not. We make it unlawful in the state of Minnesota. This is actually when I got here was the first time that I saw this from the University of Minnesota, and I appreciate that they state here that they are not doing it. So I appreciate that. Like I said, this is the first time I saw that sheet of paper. They didn't contact me prior, but I think that given the idea that we don't want human cloning in the state of Minnesota, I think then it's perfectly legitimate to make it unlawful in the state of Minnesota so it doesn't happen.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, but Senator Fischbach, if nobody's proposing doing it, my only concern is about how it might have impact on stem cell research. And seeing lots of people I know who have family members with MS and cystic fibrosis and ALS and a number of the other things where there is some real potential progress there. I guess that's my concern. It's nothing. My concern isn't about the cloning portion. It's what else this covers. And again, my point is, if you say, well, we can't do human cloning, fine, but what do you mean by human cloning? And is there anything in here where you talk about that I saw in here earlier today, the shipping or receiving in part, anything there for the purpose of human cloning, that's fine. But what about stem cell research? Is there anything else in there? I read your thing on the scientific research, and I'm glad you reduced the penalties for something that I don't think anybody's talking about doing. But if there is stem cell research that some of us think is appropriate and that might be helpful to people with certain conditions and so on,
I know if you have even a misdemeanor penalty, you're gonna stop any potential research on that. And that's my concern, not the cloning. It's what other impacts the language would do.
Mr. Chair, Fishbach. I think that Ms. Rao has something that she'd like to add on that.
Ms. Rao.
If you don't mind, sure. Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, Senator Marty, this bill is actually very, very specific in what is included in this prohibition and what is not. The only thing that is included is the cloning of an actual human being, so the creation of a new embryo, which would be like a new individual. This does not include any other kinds of embryonic stem cell research. This does not include creating new tissues. We had this bill up in committee in the House earlier today, and there was a question. I know the university has been doing research where they created a heart, a new heart tissue. This does not affect that in any way. The only things that are affected by this bill are things that are specifically the cloning of a new human embryo.
Mr. Chairman, it may be a good bill. I may be willing to support it. I guess I'd like to hear from some of the researchers, and I assume nobody here tonight on it, but it may be a bill that's worth supporting. I just am really uncomfortable about what it might have an impact on stem cell research.
Senator Sheridan?
Well, I appreciate, thank you, Chair. I appreciate what you're just saying. I just do not know the language. I don't understand this language well enough to know that what it would restrict in terms of stem cell research, and if the capacity to do other kinds of research that can impact, being able to really have a replenishment of certain tissues in the body, or spinal cord injury repair, that kind of research is, I think, really important. And I'm agreeing with what Senator Marty said here. It's just that and when I read the language here, not understanding most of these words, it raises that concern that to produce a living organism, on line 1.13, to produce a living organism at any stage of development that is genetically virtual, identical to existing or previously existing human organism. That language is what I'm not sure of the implications of that. Mm-hmm. If it is as you describe it, I think it sounds good, but I just would like to be affirmed from a researcher that that is in fact the case.
Ms. Rao.
Chairman and Senator Sharon, I am not a researcher, so perhaps I can't give you the affirmation that you're seeking. However, I would like to point out to you subdivision 5, which starts on lines 2.3 through 2.6. And in that section, we detail specifically what is not covered. And it says specifically that, the creation of molecules, DNA, cells other than human embryos, anything that's not a human embryo, is not covered. The creation of tissues, organs, plants, or other animals. All of those things are not affected by this legislation. As this researcher Janish that I mentioned in my testimony talked about, 10 years ago there was a lot of discussion about human cloning, and a lot of researchers in the scientific community thought that this was really going to be a great way to lead to a whole bunch of new therapies. They've tried that, and like Janish and like others, they're continually turning away from that. And in that time, the scientific community and researchers, including at the U, have come up with all sorts of new ways to get at what they were trying to do or hoping to do through human cloning. For example, there's one kind of research that is most commonly known as IPS. It stands for induced pluripotent cell research. And what they do with that is they take an adult cell, just any cell from your body, essentially, and they try to revert it back so that it can then turn into a pluripotent cell, which just means a cell that can turn into different kinds of tissue. And that's what they were trying to get at with human cloning research, was to be able to create various tissues that can be used in transplantations and those kinds of things. And so they have now found other ways to do that without cloning. Now, what this language talks about, as I mentioned earlier, it's very specific to only the cloning of human embryos. And once you have a human embryo, if you were going to try to derive some kind of tissue from it, you would have to grow that embryo. If you wanted to grow a heart, then you'd have to grow the embryo and have the whole thing grow, the whole body, and then harvest the heart. Now, I don't think anybody here would think that that was appropriate. I certainly hope not. I don't think anybody would. But that's the only thing that you could do with it, if you were trying to get a heart from it. So they're finding all sorts of new ways to do what they were hoping to do before, and the cloning aspect is not working, and the other new methods of research are. And so the reason for this is because we want Minnesota to be at the forefront of research, and cloning is not where the most important research is going. And 2 years ago, we did have a ban on taxpayer funding of human cloning that was put into law. However, it was just session law. It was a 2-year ban. And so this year we're looking, we need to either renew that, or we would prefer to just see a ban on the procedure altogether.
Thank you. Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, and Senator Fischbach, after this discussion, I think it would be appropriate to add a sentence to the end of line 2.6 that would say, nothing in this section shall restrict human stem cell research. I mean, what we've had as discussion here is said that this is not a bill to to restrict that research, and it seems to be the flashpoint of this bill, and so I think that it would be good to clarify that.
I'm going to oppose the amendment simply because I don't think we can, on the fly, so to speak, define that. There's a lot of definitions that would have to be, I think, added or somehow figured out. And I think that the subdivision 5 that we have under the scientific research does define what we're trying to get at and is crafted that we get at human cloning, which is what we are directing this legislation at. So I would have to oppose the amendment.
Thank you. Senator Fischbach, I'm not sure that Senator Higgins actually has offered an amendment. Maybe I misheard her. But if she hasn't offered an amendment, we really don't have anything to vote. But if it was an amendment and you do want to vote, we certainly can. But
and Mr. Chair, I do. It's just an oral amendment, but I would like to offer it.
All right. Senator Higgins offers the amendment. Could you restate your amendment, please?
At the end of line 2.6, insert the following sentence. Nothing in this section shall restrict human stem cell research.
Nothing in this section shall restrict
human stem cell research.
Stem cell research. Do we have that for the record? Yes, we do. Members, Senator Higgins offers oral amendment at the end of line 6, add, nothing in this section shall restrict human stem cell research, period.
That's it.
That is the amendment. Any discussion on the amendment? Senator Sharon.
I appreciate this amendment, and I would just ask the author to support this because I can vote for the bill with this language, and if for some reason it needs further defining, it can be done. It still can be done after it moves out of this committee. And I'd like to support you in the bill, but I'd also want to be respectful to what the concerns are at the university's research. So I'm hoping you'll consider the support.
Senator Fischbach.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. I, like I said, now that we actually have an amendment, I will not support the actual, or do not support the actual amendment, simply because there isn't any, I mean, the university is not, like I said, this is the first time that I've seen the information from the university, and is that what they're really trying to get at? Would the language that we have in front of us even get at it? I don't know, because doing this kind of language, very quickly doesn't always get to exactly what we want. So I'm just going to say I would not support the amendment. I think that we have sufficient information in the scientific research section here, and if there's something that we do later, possibly, I don't know. But right now I'm going to stick with what we've got in the bill.
Other questions, discussion? On Senator Higgins' amendment, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The amendment is not adopted. Senator Fischbach.
If there's no further discussion or amendments, I'll renew my motion on 695 as amended to be passed to Judiciary.
The motion from Senator Fischbach is to pass and send, refer it to the Judiciary Committee.
Judiciary, yep.
On that motion, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
No.
Motion is carried.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Fischbach.
Much.
And thank you, members, for your patience. It is 8 o'clock, and we are adjourned.